science enthusiasts. I'm your host, Jason Zukowski. I'm a high school chemistry teacher, but you probably know our dogs, Bunsen and Beaker. They're the science dogs on social media. This show takes what's best from their account, the curiosity and fun found there, and swirls it into podcast form. Every week, we're going to take some deep dive into an area of science and look at the research that's going on with our pets. We'll also have an expert guest who will enthrall you with their area of knowledge. This is the Science Podcast. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Science Podcast. It's the start of August. July has gone by so fast. A lot of fun projects I've been working on, and it's been great to have a vacation from school. We're heading out to the coast soon, so that's exciting for our family. And then guess what? Before you know it, it'll be mid-August, and it's time to start thinking about getting ready for school again. But it's just the start of August, so we're not there yet. On the Science Podcast this week, in science news, we're going to take a look at anoles, little tiny lizards, and how they breathe underwater. In pet science, we're going to look at how dogs lie to other dogs about how big they are. It's kind of a cute study. Our expert guest this week is Dr. Nicholas Cooley, who studies organic chemistry and biosynthetic gene clusters. What? Can't wait for you guys to hear that interview. Hey dogs, did you know that organic chemistry is usually difficult for my students? Yeah, they have all kinds of trouble. All kinds of trouble. All kinds have a triple bond between carbon. Okay, on with the show, because there's no time like science time. This week in science news, we're going to take a look at some science coming out of Canada. Chris Bocina of Queen's University in Kingston, actually, they looked at how anoles breathe underwater, and they have this crazy, crazy adaptation. Anoles are little lizards, and one of the things that is common about these little lizards, if you bug them and they're in the water, they dive. And they can dive for a long time before they come up for air. They can actually hold their breath for upwards of 20 minutes. That's a long time to hold your breath. Have you guys ever tried holding your breath? I used to be a competitive swimmer. And when I was at the height, peak fitness of young Jason, I could swim two lengths of the pool. So 50 meters. This was an outdoor swimming pool. So I could swim 50 meters on a single breath. And that was always got a ooh or an awe out of the kids. I can still do one whole length of a pool, 25 meters, without coming up for breath. And as an older guy, that definitely impresses the whippersnappers. But 20 minutes? No way. So it's always been, for these lizards, it's been a mystery as to how they can hold their breath for so long. In 2009, an evolutionary biologist, Luke Mayer, has been studying one of the anoles. It's an endangered species. He caught the thing, and he released it back into a clear stream, like something that you could see clearly from the top to the bottom. And that's where he noticed the weird adaptation. As the animal kind of went all the way down to the bottom, it exhaled an air bubble on its snout, and it seemed to breathe in and out through this air bubble. He called it a bubble-headed lizard. Anyways, he had to move to explore more for his work, but he never forgot about this weird lizard adaptation. So Bessie and his team traveled to Costa Rica in 2017. Costa Rica's beautiful, by the way. We went there with students on a marine biology trip. Absolutely amazing. In search of these bubble-headed anoles, because that's what this little lizard was. They had to wear all of these headlamps, and they had to capture all of these little lizards. They captured 300 of them, and they weren't all the same species. They were a hodgepodge of ones from near streams to out in the jungle. So they have like all of these lizards in lizard buckets, or I don't know how you capture an anole. The study wasn't too clear on this. They hauled them back to their camp, and you know what they did? Is they just dunked them in water. And what they found under careful observation was all of the anoles carried a little bubble of air around their snout, and they breathed the bubble in and out. So it's like they were bringing their own scuba tank with them that rode on their face. So the lizards were able to stay underwater for a long time. The longest one in this study was 18 minutes. And the researchers made a note that they were very worried about this little lizard, but it turned out to be fine. Now, one interesting thing is that anoles have a skin that repels water. The adaptation of the anole's skin might play a role. They have water-repelling skin, and so as the anole dives, the hypothesis is that a thin layer of mist might get trapped next to their skin. So when the lizard breathes out and air goes out of their nose, it expands that trapped air layer like a bubble. Now that air in the bubble, it will have less oxygen over time because they're rebreathing the little bubble of air. And that turned out to be true. They actually tested it with little tiny oxygen sensors to make sure that was actually happening. And the other thing they noticed is when the anoles were staying underwater for a long periods of time, they slowed down. They weren't moving around as much. And if you've seen people practicing to hold their breath for long periods of time, I believe in the new season on Disney Plus of Brain Games, Kara, who was on her podcast, Kara Santa Maria, she trained herself to hold her breath, and you have to really relax and slow everything down. That way they don't need to use as much oxygen and breathe out less carbon dioxide. Animals that have a close relationship with water, you know, they have to get their oxygen somehow. Fish have gills, obviously. And if you think about a whale, they just really hold their breath for a long time and come up for air. But these little anoles, they take their own oxygen with them in little face scuba diving tanks. Pretty cute. That's science news for this week. This week in Pet Science, it's all about dogs lying to other dogs about how big they are. My sister Alana has this little dog named Calvin. You might have seen some pictures of him. Bunsen tolerates Calvin. Calvin can be grouchy to Bunsen sometimes. When Bunsen was younger, they played together, but because of COVID, they haven't seen each other for a while. So Bunsen just kind of ignores Calvin. Calvin's kind of grouchy if Bunsen gets too close. But someone who doesn't put up with that is Beaker. So Calvin was a bit grouchy to Beaker. And Beaker was like, that's not how we do things. And was grabbed Calvin's scruff and was hauling him off the couch to do we don't know what with. Calvin was like trying to bite Beaker, and it was not good for this little dog. Calvin's like this little teeny tiny Morky thing. So we stopped that, and we made sure they were separated, and told Beaker she shouldn't have done that. It raises a good point, because Calvin sometimes, as Lana will tell everybody, bites off more than he can chew all the time. He's got the small dog syndrome or something, she jokingly calls it. And it's probably just because he's little and he feels threatened because he's just a tiny thing. If you've seen Doc, my father-in-law's miniature schnauzer, Calvin's like a third the size of Doc. So Calvin's tiny, very, very small. Like Bunsen's paw is as big as Calvin. So what does this have to do with it? What does the story have to do with the study? Well, Linda Sharp, who's an ecologist at the Australian National University in Canberra, talked about what could be happening with small dogs with urination. They compared it to another animal, a dwarf mongoose, and they leave these dwarf mongoose leaves their scents from their butts, their anal glands, by doing headstands. And the males will try and reach their butt up as high as possible. So it looks like they're way taller than they normally are. And the interesting thing is that dogs may do the same thing. The data shows they do. The correlation, do they do that to show that they're bigger? Well, that's the question. Now, conducting this study to prove something like this wasn't super easy. They had to study 45 dogs from different shelters, and the animals, the dogs were a whole bunch of mixed breeds, and they wanted adult males because the adult males were more likely to lift their leg when they pee. Then the dogs had to pee at a certain area, a pee spot, and they had to not distract the dog from peeing. And there's a whole bunch of variables that constantly went wrong. One of the lead authors of the study was quoted as saying, "We spent an inordinate amount of time out there." So you can see just in that one quote, they're maybe frustrated with trying to get the dogs to pee in the right spot. So as the dogs made a pee mark, the researchers measured the height and the angle from the dog's leg, the angle, all right. And they analyzed a whole bunch of different leg lifts. Urination angle, meaning how high the dog peed, the conclusion of the study got higher and more extreme as the animals got smaller and smaller. So little dogs like Kelvin will pee way higher to potentially lie about how big they are. They exaggerate their size. It could be sending a message to other male dogs, like, I'm big and tough, watch out for me. It could be sending a message to female dogs, hey, there's a big dog out here ready to get jiggy with you. I don't know. So the fact is it happens, but why it happens, obviously we can't get into a dog's head and ask the little dogs why you peeing so high. Finally, there may be no conclusion aside from the fact of the physiology of the little dogs. Big dogs can't lift their legs as high, thus the angle's lower. Little dogs are a little bit more nimble and can raise their legs higher, so the angle is more extreme. I don't know. I'll have to watch Kelvin when he pees and compare it to Bunsen. Bunsen's so big he can pee over Kelvin. We're not taking a video of that. That's Pet Science for this week. Hey everybody, thanks for listening to the Science Podcast this week. The Science Podcast is always going to be free to download, but if you want to support the show, there's a couple things you can do. The first one is sign up on our Patreon page, patreon.com/Bunsen Burner. There's multiple tiers of support. We have a ton of fun with the patron group. You get to be on the podcast. You get postcards from Bunsen and Beaker. You get swag. You get early pictures. You get a whole bunch of awesome stuff. So check it out. The lowest tier is only $5 a month. The other way you could support the show is checking out our merch shop. Our merch shop is hilarious. It's got all of these adorable cartoons of Bunsen and Beaker. We keep producing more. I just want to thank the people that have supported the show that way. We're really, really proud of our merch shop because the merch, the clothes, is really high quality. The colors are vibrant, and we come up with some really fun designs all the time. So check it out. That's at BunsenBurnerBMD.com. Thanks, everybody. On to the interview. It's time for Ask an Expert on the Science Podcast, and I have Dr. Nicholas Cooley, who's a postdoc at the University of Pittsburgh, with me today. How are you doing today, Nick?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm good. So I usually ask guests where they are in the world, but since you're a postdoc in Pittsburgh, are you in Pittsburgh right now?
I am, yeah. My girlfriend and I live here up on Mount Washington, overlooking the city, and it's pretty rainy today, and my dogs are a little upset about that, but it's nice here. We really like Pittsburgh.
We're like this. I'm not sure when this podcast will come out because I bank interviews, but Western Canada is suffering through this crazy heat wave right now. So it's like temperatures we're not even used to. So we are hoping for a little bit of rain coming up here pretty soon.
Yeah, I've been hearing a lot about the Pacific Northwest, at least the U.S. side. I guess I don't hear that much about Canada, but I assume it's similar up there.
Alberta doesn't necessarily get super hot. Like, our summers are nice, but having temperatures in the high 30s for a week at a time, degrees Celsius, so that's close to 100 Fahrenheit, is kind of not normal, especially in June. But the other question I always ask guests kind of to start with, how are you and your family doing with coronavirus? That's kind of touched the whole world.
We are thankfully doing pretty well. My parents are a bit older, but they're retired and they were able to pretty much be like to isolate themselves. And that was fine. My girlfriend's parents, one is still working and the other's retired, and they think they got coronavirus at one point, although they didn't have particularly severe cases. But we're doing fine. My girlfriend and I are both vaccinated, and I'm starting to go back into work for meetings. And because almost everybody I know at work is vaccinated.
But yeah, so it makes it pretty
safe. We're thankfully safe, doing okay.
Yeah, it makes a pretty safe environment when everybody's vaccinated. Okay, that's good to hear. I'm gonna have to stop asking that question soon, I think. I've been asking that for like a year, but it's
hopefully the Delta variant stuff isn't going to be bad, but it looks a little scary. And like, other parts of the world are still having a really rough time. You know, anywhere that's not highly developed or hasn't had access to vaccines is not doing great.
This is true. Yeah. In some areas of the United States, the vaccination rate's like 40%. And in some areas of Canada too, like rural Canada, where it's tough to get the vaccine in, the vaccination rate's really low too.
And then, yeah, that's true. Other parts of the world just don't have access to it. So hopefully that's going to change in the next year.
Yeah, that would be great. I know that there have been efforts here in the US to push or to get vaccines out to places that typically wouldn't have access to them as quickly, but it's hard to really know how effective those will be. I mean, we'll just have to see and kind of hope for the best.
Right. If we do better when everybody else does better, right?
Canada definitely.
And the United States' rates are slowing and other places are skyrocketing, it just takes one little mutation and maybe the vaccine isn't super effective against that. So, yeah.
The vaccine is sort of targeting a really specific part of the virus, and the virus has a lot of mutational space. So we don't really know what's going to happen in the future. Like we hope that the more people who are vaccinated, the less mutational space the vaccine or the virus has access to, but it's kind of, who knows?
Yeah. The longer you leave a kettle percolating on the stove, the greater the chance it's going to boil over. So that's the analogy some people have said to me. All right. Well, okay. Let's get back to who you are with your training in science. I'm really excited to talk to you. Could you tell everybody a little bit about what you do in your career? You have a PhD, and you're in an area of science that I adore. Go ahead.
I originally did my undergraduate training in molecular genetics and microbiology. So very long time ago at this point, it seems. And I really enjoyed that, but it turned out that I was a little bit of a, I wasn't the greatest undergraduate student, so I had a bit of a hard time getting into graduate school, and I have an older brother who's considerably older than me, and he had just joined faculty at the University of Missouri, and he was trying to sort of push their chemistry department towards doing more biological chemistry, and he basically came to me and said, look, we generally accept most of our applicants. You would not be outside of the norm for us. Just come and join our chemistry department and, you can work for pretty much anybody here except for me and it'll be fine. And so I went to Mizzou. Yeah, it's one of these interesting little tidbits. The big Midwestern public institutions often have a slightly difficult time recruiting a lot of candidates for their PhD programs, even though they pay them, though not always that well. So I went to do my PhD in organic chemistry at the University of Missouri, which turned out to be a lot of fun. And it was a sort of easy transition for me because I had been pretty good at organic chemistry in undergrad. And I spent a bunch of time doing this thing, which is called fluorescent sensor chemistry. And what that is we made small molecule fluorescent sensors for studying biological analytes. And one of the good examples of this is if you've ever seen a picture of a cell where certain like organelles or features of the cell are lit up, this is usually either done with a fluorescent protein tag or a small chemical that is fluorescent, like tags onto things. And we built those tags and those sensors. And
cool. So you built like the Velcro that the stuff sticks to.
Well, you can think about it like you build the fluorophore itself, and sort of the way that it's called in the field is the binding motif that causes the fluorophore to stick to things.
Oh yeah. Okay.
So yeah. So that was what I did for my PhD. And functionally, that process was really just building really difficult to build carbon-carbon bonds, which is stressful and sometimes not very fun. And this sort of led me to really dig into the fact that bacteria are great chemists. Bacteria are fantastic chemists. Like anything that we do at the bench, like building molecules, bacteria can do considerably more efficiently with much cheaper starting materials. So like if you think about some generic reaction, a chemist goes to the bench, they start with like starting materials A and B, they throw them in a flask, they heat it up, they add stuff, typically an organic solvent, and stir it around, and then hopefully something C comes out. That's a really it's a typically really inefficient process, because even when you get like really high conversions, which are referred to as yields in the field, you know, you've expended a lot of energy heating something up. You have used typically somewhat expensive and difficult to deal with organic solvents that have to be, you know, in graduate school, you know, you just hand it off to EHS and EHS has to deal with it and you don't ever worry about it again. But
it goes to the people that take care of it.
Yeah. But like on an industrial scale, there's a lot of, you know, industrial scale chemistry that is not always the greatest. And bacteria particularly, and sometimes plants, do a lot of really awesome chemistry incredibly efficiently. And I got really, really interested in this because I was like, yeah, look, you know, doing this at the bench sucks. And so I started looking for postdocs where I could sort of segue into doing biological chemistry. And I landed here in Pittsburgh working with a guy who had just got a faculty position, and he had gotten his faculty position with their proposal of doing antibiotic discovery, looking for novel gene clusters that bacteria use to build the molecules that they basically use to fight each other, and then that we then sort of co-opt to use as antibiotics.
Mm. Okay, very interesting. Couple follow-up questions. Is one of the reasons why the bacteria are so much better than you guys and as chemists is because they've got like millions of years of a time ahead of you on this kind of stuff?
That is pretty much the most succinct answer. Like there's a lot of things that go into that. So typically the way that bacteria do chemistry is they have all these really, really specialized enzymes. And it obviously took them a very, 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 very long time to develop all those. But what those enzymes typically do is they force compounds into particular configurations that basically make it so that reactions only occur in certain ways. They like put parts of compounds next to transition metals that sort of change either like the pH or the electronic structure of something and make something way more likely. Hmm. Because when you do a reaction in solution, I think this can be difficult to visualize sometimes, but you basically have really diffuse compound like just floating around in your solution, and mostly, you know, you have your organic solvent bouncing around, and every once in a while your starting materials like bounce into each other in a way that your catalyst or your base or your acid allows them to react in the way that you want. And so there's a lot of randomness that you have to overcome to successfully do reactions in a flask, whereas, you know, the course of evolution has given bacteria the tools to basically avoid that randomness.
I try to explain that randomness to my chemistry students because you're hoping for the right randomness to occur as well, right? Like not only is it random, you have to hope for the right randomness. And my analogy I tell kids is like if you took two kids and you blindfolded them and you made them run around the gym as fast as they could, you had to have to hope they'll eventually hit each other, but hit each other the right way too. So
yes, that's a great analogy.
And we did that once, but it was super dangerous and we never did it again because the kids just about ran full on into each other. But anyways, and my other question before we move on is, so you've taken this, like, you took an undergrad, you moved on to a PhD and you're a postdoc. What got you interested in science in the first place?
That's kind of an interesting question. Like I don't consider myself one of these people that was like really driven by any one event or any one big desire to get into science. I think that the biggest thing was I was really aimless. I was one of these people that like, I didn't do anything in high school. Like I played sports and I played video games and sometimes I did my homework. And that sort of continued to a small extent in undergrad until I started to run into some courses that like really kind of piqued my interest. And the first time I took an outside of a gen ed biology class, like I started to like actually like academic material that was put into me, that was put in front of me for the first time at like the age of like 20 or 19. And it sort of segued from there. I just started, you know, taking more of those classes and I eventually did some undergraduate research for a guy at Ohio State that was working on acanth amoeba. And then, you know, I really liked it. And I was like, man, maybe I should go to graduate school.
So that's interesting. You know, I've talked to guests before, and yeah, there are like events in people's lives that they're like, pow, I'm going to be a scientist. But other guests like yourself are like, you know, I just kind of like liked the idea of science and found my way to where I am right now. And that sounds like that's your story.
Yeah, that is definitely my story.
Cool. Okay, so one of the questions I have for you that maybe you could answer for our audience is, in your bio, and you've already talked about it, you've talked about, or you've said the word organic chemistry, organic solvent. And for some of our audience members who didn't go to advanced science or didn't take science in high school, or maybe they're a little rusty, could you explain what organic chemistry is? Like, what is it? We've never had somebody really explain it to our audience before.
Okay, I think that's a big responsibility. I think that the easiest and most accessible way to describe it is organic chemistry is really the science of like how we make stuff. So like if you think about like everything maybe that's on your desk in front of you or in your car, you know, you can break it down into things that are metal, things that are plastic, you know, things that are leather maybe, you know, things that are wood or whatever, right? And how we make particularly those plastic things is sort of organic chemistry. It's like, can I take something and convert it to something else? So like I think the earliest forms of organic chemistry that we think about are like people who realize that if you take petroleum, you could like separate it out into all of these different fractions, and each of these different fractions had something interesting. And I think one of the really specific stories of that is we first isolated some of these really bright and kind of at the time expensive blue dyes from petroleum fractions. And that's sort of my intro to it, I guess. I don't know if I have the best explanation of it, but that's how I think about it.
So it says
the science of how we make stuff.
The science of how we make stuff. Yeah. And petroleum at one time was something that was alive. Like it's the remnants of something that was once living.
Yeah.
The other thing that you work with are these things called biosynthetic gene clusters. That's another kind of like buzzword I've heard a few times now lately. Could you talk about what biosynthetic gene clusters are?
Sure. So functionally, so if you think about all of these drugs that we have access to, particularly antibiotics and in some cases anti-tumor agents, they mostly come from biological sources. So like famously, we think about, say, aspirin as coming from, it's like the bark of some tree. There's a really famous case of an anti-tumor agent called Taxol that comes from the yew tree. There are... So penicillin comes from an aspergillus fungi that makes this compound to fight off bacteria. And so all of these organisms that we sort of encounter in our daily lives make chemicals. And particularly in bacteria, the genetic tools that bacteria use to make these chemicals are co-localized. So they sit right next to the genes, sit right next to each other on like the chromosome. Those clusters, oftentimes they're very, very unique, and sometimes they're that we find them everywhere. And there's this idea that if we can become better at finding them and characterizing them, we can do things like develop antibiotics better or search for anti-tumor agents better and more cheaply. And so we sort of pursue that research avenue here at the University of Pittsburgh.
Oh, awesome. So is that one of the end goals of your postdoc, or is that like just gathering more information? What you're doing right now?
So we're funded under a couple NIH grants that are targeted at doing better detection of these biosynthetic gene clusters, so that I guess the sort of the elephant in the room of that is that it's modestly cheap to do computational biology, and it is incredibly expensive to do molecular biology, both in terms of resources and people's time, and also space as well. But that's, you know, another ball game. And so the idea is that if we make better tools to predict where these gene clusters are, then we can more efficiently do the molecular biology to either confirm that they do what, you know, we thought they did, or do more targeted exploratory molecular biology to find and, you know, isolate and describe these compounds that could potentially be of use to us.
Right. Okay. So I totally get it. That's really important, because that's what basically CRISPR has done, right? Genetic editing used to be a random crapshoot of crazy expensive techniques. And CRISPR's like on an order of magnitude decreased that. And now they're hoping for all of these different breakthroughs because it's so much cheaper and faster to do that kind of science. That's where I'm feeling you're working on with this biosynthetic gene cluster business.
Yeah. So CRISPR. So even despite my training mostly in the wet lab, I'm now pretty much a computational biologist or a bioinformatician, depending on how you want to, you know, term that field. And my boss is as well. And our goal is to make these tools to make these databases that when a molecular biologist can come along and say, well, instead of having to test these like 50 or 500 or 5,000 clusters, like I really only need to test these like, you know, 10 or 5 or these 3. And the hope is that like our work up front does better detection and therefore, you know, with the limited resources that the NIH provides to academic users, that, you know, molecular biologists have a better and, you know, more efficient time.
It's an order of magnitude reduction of time. Like, that's super important in science.
That's what we'd hope. So I guess one of the underlying pieces of this that I guess I skipped over is that antibiotic discovery is really it's not something that drug companies are really super into, because it's not something they make a lot of money on, which is a little unfortunate because we need good antibiotics. Mm-hmm. But if a drug company develops a brand new antibiotic, one of the first things that happens is that it gets designated as an antibiotic of last resort, and then it gets used considerably less. And this drug company that's threw an enormous amount of money at the research and development of this product then can't like sell that product widely, which is really what we'd want, because, you know, we want people to have access to lots of different antibiotic choices, because having access to many choices allows, you know, clinicians to sort of, you know, it gives them a better arsenal to treat infections.
When they have more tools in their toolbox.
Yeah, but because, you know, our regulatory agencies are really scared of, you know, multi-drug resistant infections and things like this, which are very scary, don't get me wrong. They designate new drugs as like last resort things really quickly. And so a drug company says, why would I spend $2 billion on this thing when I'm never going to be able to sell it widely enough to recoup that expense? But if, you know, if it's say not $2 billion for them to do the work, then maybe they're more likely to do it.
Right. A couple $100,000 instead of like crazy money. Gotcha.
That's the long-term hope.
Whatever number there is. Yeah. I don't know. I just threw that number out there. Okay. Well, that's very cool. Thanks for explaining that. That's going to make our listeners more confident when they hear about that, and also some of the inner workings of what goes into that kind of research. My last question before we move on, you mentioned how hard I forget when in your training you were trying to make these weird carbon-carbon bonds that were really tough to make. Could you explain why it was tough to make those carbon-carbon bonds? Because normally carbon likes to kind of bind to itself.
So typically, if you want to make a carbon-carbon bond, you start with a product where both of the carbons that you're trying to put together have some sort of accessible functional groups on them. So one of the really famous and common and sort of examples that we teach to beginning undergrads and things is something like the aldol reaction. So if you have a ketone where you have a carbon that's sort of directly bonded to the carbon in your carbonyl, it's really easy to deprotonate that thing, and then you have a functional group that can then sort of act nucleophilically, and you can do all this stuff with that. But if you have carbons that don't have functional groups on them, it can be incredibly difficult to like put things together in the way that you want to. And I spent a lot of time taking what were essentially vinyl chlorides and trying to couple them to alkynes and amines and boronates in ways that are sort of outside the scope of what existed in the literature at the time. So the standard process when you're a graduate student is you have some reaction in front of you that you want to do, and you say, well, you know, who has done something very similar? Because often you're trying to do something that someone else hasn't done before. And you sort of troll through the literature and you say, well, you know, this person has a starting material that looks a little bit like mine, and so I'm going to try their conditions. And that is sometimes a crapshoot, and sometimes it's really successful. And I was doing it in a case where my starting material was this really big fluorophore. So it had all these funny, like, it had this really big funny pi system, and it was pretty fragile, and I couldn't heat it up a lot, and I couldn't put it in certain solvents. And the things I was trying to put on it were really bad coupling partners. And so it was this really...
So it's like you're trying to build a bunch of, you know, like carbon, if you think of it as Lego, you're trying to build some kind of molecule with Lego that the pieces really don't want to snap together at all.
Yeah, exactly. And I think I probably went a little bit off track with your question, but oftentimes the task of building carbon-carbon bonds is typically given to catalysis. So in organic chemistry, people use a lot of palladium catalysis, which is really actually quite interesting, because palladium is one of the really common contaminants in drug manufacturing that drug companies are very, very strict about making sure is below like acceptable levels, because you don't want a lot of palladium and stuff. It's not great. But it's also incredibly expensive. So from the view of a drug company, if they have to do any catalysis in the manufacture of the drug that they're trying to produce, it's expensive to have the catalysis, or it's expensive to have the catalyst, and it's expensive to get rid of it successfully. So they try and avoid it.
Yeah.
Right.
So you need this thing to make the reaction work, and it's both expensive and it sticks around, which isn't good.
Yes. But from the perspective of a graduate student, you don't really care, right?
Like, yeah,
well,
right.
Did I, is my NMR pure or not? Like, I don't know. Right?
Yeah, so, you're like, go science.
Yeah, pretty much. But yeah, so carbon-carbon bond formation, when you have functional groups, is typically easy. But when you don't have access to those, or maybe the functional groups that you have access to aren't well described in literature, it can be incredibly difficult. So there's a sort of subgenre of organic chemistry papers where they do, like, they show, oh, I built this. The dogs are getting rowdy. Where they sort of say, oh, I built this brand new. I built this like this new catalyst, and I want you all to use it, right? And they do these like this, they try and show the scope of the catalyst. So they say, oh, you know, it works with these functional groups like A to Z, and this is how well it works, and like, look at all, and they say, like, you know, my yields range from X to Y, and this is really good in comparison with, you know, whatever else existed before whatever they made. And that's a subgenre, but it's becoming a little less common nowadays, and I'm not quite sure why. You'd have to ask the funding agencies.
Okay.
But that's, those are sort of the people who are most in tune with how difficult it is to sort of make new things, but they also are sort of living in this world where they think also a lot about like the metals that they use. So you can use palladium for catalysis. You can use nickel. You can use iron. You can use gold. You can use copper. And they all have sort of their own strengths and weaknesses. Palladium is sort of the most versatile. So it's one that gets used a lot in academic science, though not being an industry person, I couldn't tell you how common it's used in industrial chemistry.
Super interesting. I am a chemistry nut. I love that. So I could listen to you talk about it all day long. So one of the questions we love asking guests is about a pet story. Since this is the science podcast, we mix science and pets, and our audience loves when guests share stories about their pets. Do you have a story from your pet's life you could share with us, or your life with pets?
So I think that the most interesting pet story that we have is about our corgi and not our burner. So I got our corgi, Winston, when I was in graduate school, and he got to spend a lot of time with my parents' retrievers. So I grew up with retrievers. My parents typically have, you know, one or two, and they try and overlap them because the dogs like to have a pack. And so Winston, the corgi, spent a bunch of time with a pair of golden retrievers. And because of this, he became quite a fan of chasing the ball. So,
oh, really? Okay.
One of the interesting things about corgis is that they absolutely need a job. Like if you get a corgi and you are unprepared for how much it is going to want to do things, you're in for a rough time. So they want a job. And if you can give them a job, they're going to be really happy. And we unwittingly taught our corgi that his job was chasing the ball, which was convenient sometimes, but also it meant that, you know, we spent like an hour a day throwing the ball for the dog, no matter the weather, whether it was raining or snowing or really hot. And that's become, he's a little older now. He's eight and he's slowed down. So that's sort of curtailed, but that's my pet story. I think that's my best one.
I love that. I've heard that from corgi owners. They, you know, you see them, they're really popular on Instagram, right? Because they're adorable. Like corgis are so cute.
Oh my god, they are adorable.
Yeah, but unwitting pet owners think that it's just like a little cute dog, but they're a demanding dog breed, like a border collie. Like you got to be prepared if you're going to get a corgi. They're not. You know, burners are super laid back most of the time. I mean, I think that's your burner that's barking because they're talky dogs sometimes, but
there's
big personality difference between a burner and a corgi.
So I have a non-me pet story that I used to when I was in Missouri and I would go to the dog park. I used to see this woman relatively frequently who had a pair of corgis, and one of them was named Diamond, and it was named Diamond because one of the sorority houses had decided that they wanted a house dog, and they went out and got a corgi.
Oh my god, and why?
Yeah, exactly. And this house of, you know, 40-odd undergraduate girls with, or undergraduate women with, like, I don't know how they had structured their oversight. But, you know, sometimes Greek houses have like house parents, which is like an adult that lives in the house with the undergraduates and tries to make sure that they behave themselves. But of, you know, this group of undergraduate women got a dog and none of them knew how to take care of it. And it was way too much for any of them. And they like panicked. And I don't know how, I forget the, like, the transition of how the woman ended up with the dog, but the woman ended up with the dog. And it lived a pretty nice life because she had a few other dogs, and it, you know, she took it all over the place. But it was like, oof.
Yeah. So, but it had a good ending, right? That, you know, like a pet that not everybody who gets a pet can handle it. And if you realize that and find a loving home for it, that's always a good end to those stories. So.
Oh yeah, that's really important. Like I have unfortunately known more than a few people who got pets that they couldn't handle. And it's always like a train wreck that you can see it coming and you don't know why they can't see it coming.
I love that with your story with the Goldens and the Corgi, because everything to a Golden, for the most part, is a game. It's not their job.
Yeah.
And a Corgi, it's like, that is my life's goal, what is happening right now. So, yeah, that's super cool. And what's your Corgi and Burner's names again?
So the Corgi is Winston.
Winston, right. I'm sorry. Yes, Winston.
Yeah, and he's 8. And our Burner is Odin. And he is, I think 16 months. So he's still pretty much a puppy.
He's a little guy. He's a puppy. He's a big, big little guy.
He is 100 pounds. Yeah.
Oh man. Yeah. They're big. They're big dogs. That's cute.
Yeah.
Do Winston and Owen get along?
Yes, they get along pretty well. Winston is the boss, which is just fine with us because Odin is too large to think he is the boss.
Yeah. So. That's hilarious. Yeah. Start that again. Bunsen thought he was the boss until Beaker showed up. Beaker is the boss for the most part.
Yeah, that's great. We're definitely okay with Winston being the boss. The 30 pounder is, you know, easy to deal with.
Awesome. The other question we always ask our guests about is the super fact. And the super fact is something that you know that when you tell people, it kind of like blows their mind a bit. Do you have a super fact you could share with us?
I think that my favorite super fact is that when you survey all life on Earth, we can sort of guesstimate like the biomass of all life on Earth. There is more biomass in bacteria than there are in animals. So like us and dogs and, you know, giraffes and everything else that's a terrestrial animal. So that's pretty clear. But there's also actually more biomass in archaea than there are in animals, which I think is absolutely wild because we don't know all that much about archaea. They're a lot like bacteria, but, you know, the typical thought about them is that they're extremophiles, but it turns out they are actually all over the place. And that, I think, is really fascinating. Bacteria and archaea are both single-celled organisms. They are both relatively simple. It turns out that we know they have fairly different membrane types. So bacteria... if you think about how cells sort of exist, one of the basic components of them is sort of a lipid membrane, and
the phospholipid bilayer.
Yes, exactly. Well, it turns out that pretty much bacteria all sort of share the same types of lipids. Like they make the same types of lipids that go into their bilayers, and those are really different in archaea. So archaea make their lipids from isoprene units instead of from 2-carbon units, which is really fascinating. So it means that, first of all, their lipids have very, very different basic components. And then they also do other really cool things with their lipids. They sometimes create ring systems within their lipid membranes. And a few of them actually, so when you think about the lipid bilayer, it's typically depicted with the tails sort of facing into each other. So the carbon-carbon tails like facing each other. Some archaea will tether those tails together so that it's not a bilayer anymore. It's a monolayer with a pair of hydrophilic head groups, which is really kind of interesting.
Yeah, that's wild. That's a great
there are a lot of other sort of really key differences, like in terms of what their replication machinery look like, a couple other things, but like that's the one that I'm really key into, and that's one of the ones that like I'm really interested in.
It's so amazing that these little tiny single-celled organisms, there's if you were to weigh them, they weigh more than all of the life that we think of as kingdom Animalia, right? And so they weigh more.
Yeah, like the vast majority of biomass on the earth is plant life, which I think probably wouldn't shock most people. But the fact that there's more like bacteria and archaea than there are like animalia is I think really something that is easy to overlook if you're not part of the field, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. You just don't think about it. You don't think about it at all. Well, that is a super fact. Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah.
The last section of the podcast is a fun one. We got to chat with guests about things that they're passionate about that is maybe outside their area of science. Some guests have talked about their love of cooking or causes that they're really into or even tattoos. What do you do outside of science that you're passionate about? Or maybe it's science itself. I don't know.
So I'm actually pretty passionate about my work, although... You know, I try and make time for, you know, other things outside of it. I think that the two things that would come up are I was a rower in undergrad.
Oh, so, cool.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun and continued were for a long time.
Were you the rower or the person that shouted to make the people row?
I was the rower.
Okay, right. Because I watched the Olympics and there's like there's always a little person that's like the smallest person just shouting. I don't know what their job is. I'm sorry. I'm super ignorant. Go ahead.
No. So that person is the coxswain. That's what
they're
called.
Oh, there you go. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. But I was a rower and I continued that for a long time until I tore the labrum in my shoulder, and I've had a long time recovering from that, which is rough. A little unfortunate. But I was super into that world, right? Like I have one of my really, really good friends coaches a really successful youth rowing program in San Diego.
Oh, cool.
You know, I have friends that have rowed at various levels, and that's kind of cool. But, you know, that's a thing of my youth. I'm trying to recover from my shoulder injury, but we'll see how that goes. The other thing is pre-pandemic used to do karaoke all the time.
Oh, that's okay. Cool.
Yeah. I recommend
guts, man. That takes so much guts.
It's really fun, and I recommend it to new graduate students all the time as a way to like get over stage fright if they're trying to learn how to be like all of this, like learning how to be a better presenter is really quite difficult, and it's often not taught well at an institutional level.
Right, yeah.
But like if you can get up on a stage in front of a bunch of drunk people and like belt out some song, whether you're good at it or not, like that's a really good way to sort of learn how to sort of create a stage presence for yourself, like sort of to learn how to, you know, manage, you know, what you're doing in front of an audience. And I think it's really fun.
I love it. So what's your best karaoke song? Like which one do you nail?
Oh, it's absolutely Thunder Road.
Thunder Road. Okay, there you go.
So the other really, really good karaoke song, which is I think is really grad school specific, is All My Friends by LCD Sound System.
Oh, okay.
If you're familiar with it, you kind of get it, like, but it's sort of it's like this meandering anthem of sort of this sadness of growing older and like, you know, drifting apart from people.
I love it. That's brilliant. I'll have to because I'm a more experienced classroom teacher now, right? So presenting to people and standing in front of everybody, it's old hat to me. But some of the young teachers, like the practicum teachers, some of them are like, because they're only, you know, 4 or 5 years older than some of the kids that they're teaching, right? And they're a little shy, so maybe I'll recommend karaoke to them.
Yeah, I mean, it's like being a good presenter is absolutely like it's a difficult skill. It's one that you have to learn. And I mean, at least my experience in graduate school was there's no institutional tools for like helping people learn how to do it.
No, and there's nothing in teaching either. Like you're the practicum students just get thrown into the fire. They're like, go teach the kids, and you're like, well, the only thing you have like what your academic knowledge. That's it, right? Like if a kid does A, you're supposed to do B for classroom management, and that never doesn't work ever. So, but I guess you don't have to really worry about that with grad students. They're not flipping desks and throwing garbage at you. So anyways,
well, sometimes who sometimes. Knows? the other one I've heard recommended is to like stand up or not stand up comedy. Well, also stand up comedy, but what's the other one where they like, where you're supposed to like riff off of each other? Yeah, improv. That's what it is. Yes.
Oh yeah. If I did improv, I'd be as good as Michael Scott from The Office. I think I just default to I always have a gun, and that's how every scene would end. So I don't know if I'd be very good at improv.
The key, you don't have to learn to be good at improv. You just have to learn like how to manage yourself in front of a crowd.
It's right. It's taking the fear out of public speaking and some showmanship too, right? I'm sure. Yes, exactly. I'm sure. Like the people that do great at presenting their posters, or I'm sure that still happens, right? You have your poster, you got to present at conferences, or whatever, your slides. If you're just a good public speaker, but if you've got some flair from that karaoke or that improv, man, it makes you a much more engaging presenter, I'd imagine.
It absolutely does. So I was really lucky. My PhD advisor, it just has the, I don't know where he learned this, but because he's actually quite an introvert, but he just has the best stage presence when he gives talks. It's like, it was really funny, right? Cause you knew him as this person that you went to with all these questions. And typically like he's very quiet and reserved, but he was famous for the way that he taught his organic chemistry class to the undergrads. Like the students loved him, and his showmanship was just phenomenal. And it was really quite wild, because like the person that, because I TA'd his class, so I would sit in on it every once in a while, and like the person that he was like on stage in front of the undergrads and the person that he was like in group meeting or in the lab or in his office were very different. And it was really interesting.
That's great.
But the students loved it, and it seemed to work out really well. They seemed to do really well, and they like retained knowledge from his class to the next one and stuff. That was really cool.
Yeah, I love that. Yep. Number one thing in educational research right now to teach students is the engagement of the student to the presenter. Doesn't matter how they do it. I don't think I'm going to be doing any karaoke anytime soon, though. I think I would tune out my students. So kudos to you for doing that. That's amazing. We're at the end of the interview. Are you on social media? Can people follow you, or do you have a website that you'd like to plug?
I do not currently have a website. I am on Twitter, though not always that active, at npcooley, at npcooley. And that's pretty much the majority of my social media presence.
That's okay. We'll make sure that's in the show notes for this this episode. So folks, you just have to click on that and you can head over to Dr. Cooley's Twitter account. Well, this has been a really fun chat. I've just enjoyed myself talking to you, especially because in my heart, my degree in science is biochemistry. So it's just stuff I love. So thanks for chatting. Thanks for chatting with us about that.
No problem. I still consider myself a lapsed organic chemist, even though I am pretty much a computational biologist at this point. So it still is the driving driving force for why I do a lot of my work is the underlying chemistry of sort of what these clusters are doing and why they're so cool. So.
Yeah, but that's the important part of science, right? Is your framework and how you tackle a problem is going to be different than another scientist. And putting all those heads together is exciting. Awesome. Well, I wish you the best of luck in your postdoc, which we did discuss has no end. There's no end point. It's just gathering. Right now you're gathering data, which is exciting though. So thanks for chatting with us today on the Science Podcast.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
It's time for Woo or Wow on the Science Podcast, and I have patron Abby Fitch with me today. How are you doing today, Abby?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me.
Yay! Where are you calling into the podcast from? Where are you in the world?
I'm located in Westlake Village, California, which is between Los Angeles and Santa Barbara.
Right. Are you part of the big mega city, or is there separation between those two?
It's pretty much a big mega city. There is no countryside between the two.
But you are in sunny California. At least that's what I hear on the movies. And I've visited California a few times, and it's definitely warmer than Alberta, Canada. How far away are you from the ocean? Like, are you further inland than I'm thinking?
About 15 minutes. So the town, we're literally directly next to Malibu.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow. So it's pretty nice. But let me tell you, I'm just going to be honest. Southern California is amazing, but Canada's got the summertime. And like right now, where I live, it's pretty hot.
Oh,
so
right.
You guys have this beautiful green summertime. So I'm really jealous.
It's short.
But glorious.
It is. This is true. And Abby, what do you do for a living?
I work in IT for a large biotechnology company.
Okay. Now, is it all hush-hush, or like you charge of networks and servers and things like that?
So what I do, actually, I lead their digital workplace technologies team, as well as their service desk team. And the company, I don't know why I couldn't say this, I work for a company called Amgen. So they're a pretty big biotech.
Oh, okay, cool. All right. So I know you're part of the Patreon group. We'll get to that in a second. But if I have computer questions, could I send you some? No, I'm just kidding.
You and my mom both.
It's all good. And Abby, you're part of our growing Patreon group. So first off, from my family to yours, thank you for supporting the podcast and Bunsen and Beaker content. How did you first hook up with Bunsen and Beaker stuff or the podcast?
So number one, you're very welcome. But I saw you guys on Twitter. I'm actually not a big Twitter person, but I absolutely love dogs and I absolutely love science. So when I ran across you guys on Twitter, I became a super fan, and you can actually even see it. I've even got your Bunsen stickers on my laptop now.
Oh, that's adorable. Thank you. Are you excited about the Beaker stuffy? I think I posted some pictures of it to the Patreon group.
I am. I somehow missed out the last time the Bunsen stuffy was offered, but I want both, especially since I'm working from home mostly these days. I can make my office look any way I want.
Yeah, it's the Beaker stuffy is a go, and I'm super excited. We are working with to make Bunsen stuffy 2.0. And it is going to be, not saying anything was wrong with Bunsen Stuffy 1.0, but 2.0 is better.
Always better. Continuous improvement, man.
Yeah. So, you ready for some trivia?
I love trivia.
Okay, so if you are tuning in for the first time to Woo or Wow, I will be challenging my guest host to try to find the true statement. So I will be reading three statements. Two of them are fake. One of them is true, two are woo, one is wow, and you have to try and find the true statement.
Okay.
Okay, all right. And the category this week is X-rays.
Ooh.
All right, are you ready?
I'm so ready.
Okay, statement one. In 2009, the X-ray was voted the most important discovery in human history, even ahead of penicillin.
Okay.
All right. Statement two. X-rays were discovered in World War II and were used to find bullet wounds and bullets still within wounded soldiers.
Okay.
Okay. And the last statement. The X in X-ray stands for extreme.
Oof. Well, that's a toughy one. I am going to go and
say, is there one that, like, just to make it a little, give you a little bit of help. Is there like one that you're leaning to that sounds kind of fishy?
So I'm very skeptical about the most important invention in human history. So I'm going to call that one out. I'm going to say no, because I would make an argument around penicillin or electricity. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to take that one as a woo.
Okay.
But then it becomes World War II soldiers or extreme. And extreme, I'm just going to say that sounds a little fishy. But I also think that for some reason I thought, you know, obviously Madame Curie started dealing with radiation. That was in the 1800s. I don't know if it took that long to get all the way back to, I don't know if it took till the 1940s to actually get to x-rays, but the timing sounds about right. So I'm going to go with, I think I'm going to go with number two being my wow, where the world in World War II, x-rays were invented and were used on wounded soldiers. I think extreme, while I like the idea, I don't think I can buy it.
Okay. It's a little out there. All right. Final answer, Abby.
Wow is World War II invention with using it for wounded soldiers.
Okay. All right. Locked you in. Dun-dun-dun-dun. All right. So let's take a look at that third statement. Something twinged in your gut about that one. And you're right. That is not true. The X in X-ray does not stand for extreme. It actually stands for unknown. Like X in an unknown quantity in mathematics.
Excellent trivia.
Yeah, that's cool. Hey, I didn't know that. I was like, well, what else would X, like there's not too many X words in the English language, like xylophone, you know? So anyways, so that brings us to the last two. One was the most important discovery. One was World War II. Which one do you want to hear first?
I want to go with the World War II one.
All right. So if this one turns out to be true, you win. But if this one is false, you lose. X-rays were first discovered in World War II and were used to find bullet wounds and bullets still in wounded soldiers. That statement is... That one is woo. That one's not true.
Dang!
X-rays were discovered in 1895, and it was in World War I the practical applications of the discovery was used. Yeah, so they were discovered much before both World War I and II. But I did a little tricky with the World War II.
Very sneaky.
Sometimes it's cited that the one of the applications of them was bullets in World War I. So
I will never forget that now.
And a meeting of scientists in 2009 in a museum in England decided that X-rays were the most important discovery in human history. Now, I don't know about that one. I don't know. I'd like to see their I'd like to see their spreadsheets and their poster papers up on the wall and be a listen to their discussions. So
I think we could have some spirited debate, but okay. Opinions differ. That's fair.
Yeah, penicillin has definitely saved a whole schwack alive. So
I just think about how electricity powers pretty much everything now.
Yeah, Faraday and his little tiny jiggly thing on the mercury. It changed human
history.
Yeah, well, I know. That's what it is.
This is also fascinating trivia. Thank you so much for letting me play, Jason. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. And again, thanks for being a patron of Bunsen and Beaker content and the podcast.
It's absolutely a pleasure.
Okay, it's time for story time with me, Adam. If you don't know what story time is when we talk about stories that have happened within the past 1 or 2 weeks. I will start. So, if you don't know, dogs can get ear infections just like humans can. It's a bit easier for them because their ears are slightly closed if they're floppy, and dogs kind of go everywhere. So Bunsen and Beaker have gotten ear infections every once in a while, you know. And when they do, you can tell because when you're snuggling with them, it'll smell like a weird men's locker room, like kind of sweaty. And it smells kind of gross, and you can kind of tell it just smells really off. And then their ear gets really gross and like crusty and oily and ew. But yeah, Bunsen and Beaker both have ear infections right now at the same time. They might have given it to each other because they fight all the time and then they bite into each other's ears. Anyway, Bunsen and Beaker both have ear infections. So kind of a gross story, but something I feel like you guys should know. Mom, do you have a story?
I sure do. Here's the grill. So what happened was this past week, I think it was this past week, Bunsen was throwing up and he wasn't feeling very well. And so we took him to the vet and he got some medication, basically anti-everything, anti-diarrhea, anti, nausea, all those anti-drugs that they gave him, and they suggested putting him on a bland diet.
Actually,
whenever a dog throws up, the vet told us that the dog should be put on a bland diet for regardless of the reason the dog threw up. So, chicken and rice it was for 4 days for Bunsen, and I got out the George Foreman grill, and unlike Michael Scott, did not cook my foot or anybody else's foot. I cooked the chicken for Adam thought the chicken was for him. So one night he had two of the chickens, which is kind of funny. And so Bunsen was on the bland diet, but he really likes the bland diet. He likes being cooked for because he is a diva. So fast forward to the day that he's supposed to be back on raw. He looked at it and he looked at me and he looked at it and he looked at me and he was like, nope, I'm not eating that. And then he took it and then he was like, no, I'm not eating that. So I'm like, oh my goodness, Jason, he's not eating his food. And Jason's like, put it away. That's his supper. He has to eat that. So I tried offering the food three more times and he was not having any of it. And so I said, well, I can't deal. If this is your food, I will sear it for you. So it reminds me of baby puppy Bunsen where he had food aversion and I seared his raw food on either side.
Did he eat it when he seared it?
Yes, he did. And then the next day, fast forward to the next day, what happened was I was like, here's your food. And he's like, I'm not eating it. And I looked at him and he looked at me and I said, Tina, eat your food. And he did not. I know. And then what happened again? I seared his food again. And I cooked it for him, and then he ate it. Now, subsequently, he's been eating Beaker's food. She is on the anti-allergy food because she's been, as Adam said, has been kind of chewing herself. So for the last couple meals, Bunsen has had kibble. And I don't know. We might go back to the raw or just keep him on the kibble just for a little bit while his tummy still heals, but he's fine. He's just a diva. So that's the rub.
Yeah. Dad, do you have a story?
I don't know if I talked about the drone last week. Did I talk about the drone last week? I don't know. I've got a drone and I've been taking aerial footage of the dogs in our property and it's been amazing. And I've got the hang of flying the thing. So I like having, it's so cool to take tracking photos of us with the dogs on our property, and it really gives you an appreciation for where we live. When I look at it, I'm just like, wow, we live on this. Everywhere in the world is really beautiful, but our little corner of it's really special. So for those of you who have saw the videos on Twitter and Instagram, I hope you enjoy them too.
Seen the videos.
What's that? Oh, if you you've seen the videos, if you've seen the videos. There was a couple people that wanted us to not do the drone videos. They like the close-up of the dogs. So I guess I'll have to intersperse it to keep the close-up people happy. Just teasing. All right, that's my story.
Got to find the happy medium. So that's story time. Now a bit of a fun story time. It's quite hot in the house. But yeah, that's story time, and I can't wait to see you guys next time. Bye-bye.
That's the end of another Science Podcast episode. Thanks so much for coming back every week to listen to our show. Special thanks to our guest this week, Dr. Nicholas Cooley, who talked to us about chemistry. I'd also like to give a special shout-out to our top-tier patrons on our growing Patreon page. If you want to hear your name, head over to the Patreon page and sign up. Take it away, Chris.
Samantha Dodd, Kimberly Bond, Nate Stevenson, Debbie Anderson, Courtney Proven, Renee Hardy, Mary Rader, Shelby Leggett, Dan Bry, Mary Coos, Katla Lynch, Marianne McNally, Andrea Persons, Elizabeth Bourgeois, Karen Beth St. George, Bianca Hyde, Lynn Armstrong, Lisa Swartz, Catherine Jordan, Donna Craig, Lila Ashier, Jody Ogren, Liz Button, Kathy Zerker, and Ben Rathers.
Let's close with the dog's motto for science, empathy, and cuteness.